Framework of quantizing quantum field theory on a curved space-time, on a generic curved space-time. Now, we will start specializing to cosmology. We could, in principle, now go towards black hole physics and Hawking radiation, for example, but in our course, we will go towards inflationary cosmology. And that means we specialize to a particular kind of space-time. We will not worry about black holes, but we will worry about this expansion of space-time. In particular, we will look into Friedmann, Robertson, Walker, or Friedmann-Lemaître space-times. I hope that you've encountered those before, but nevertheless, let us review some of the basics and let us clarify some key issues about them that we need to be completely clear about if we want to quantize a kind of golden field in the background of an expanding space-time. So what's the motivation for considering FRW space-times? Aminit, could you please close that door too? Thank you. But we start with this observation. Galaxies, just like any matter, curve space around them. I mean, where they are and around where they are. So locally, there certainly is curvature around. Curvature is the reason why we orbit the sun, for example, and so on. However, astronomers tell us that if you look at sufficiently large scales, scales much larger than the scale of a galaxy, so much larger than 100,000 light years, but you don't have to go as large as the size of the part of the universe that's causally connected to us, 13.7 billion light years. No, somewhere in the middle, it begins that the phenomenon starts that space-time is pretty much flat. If you average over little dents that are because of the presence of galaxies, then as far as the astronomers can tell us, space-time happens to be spatially pretty much flat. Which means, concretely, that if you take a triangle whose sides are very, very large, in the order of many millions of light years, let's say, then the angles add up to 180 degrees. Pythagoras' theorem holds. So therefore, for the purpose of cosmology, it is usually a good assumption, or it's a good approximation, to treat space-time as being spatially completely flat, assuming that all the triangles really have a sum of angles that is 180 degrees, Pythagoras holds, and so on. And parallel transport is trivial, spatially. This still leaves open the possibility that space-time may contract or expand. And not only that, if you make the assumption that space-time is completely flat spatially, it doesn't mean that you have only one parameter left, namely a parameter that describes expansion or contraction. No, you see, space-time could expand or contract in different directions in different amounts and still stay spatially flat all the time. So far, the experimental evidence indicates that the expansion is actually isotropic, that space-time is expanding in all directions the same amount or at the same rate. It didn't have to be like that. Eventually, we will need an explanation for this. And in fact, it's not a stable thing.
Why?
Oh, why it would expand in the first time, in the first place? Well, we will find a mechanism that will make it expand. We will ask, what is it in the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation that could lead space-time to expand? It turns out that when you have a potential in the Klein-Gordon equation and the potential is elevated, then this will act to make spacetime expand.
Yes, spacetime could be anything. It
could be very curved, and it could be expanding here more than there and in different directions differently. But once we make the assumption that spacetime is spatially everywhere the same, everywhere flat, once we make that assumption, this still leaves open the possibility that spacetime is shrinking and expanding in different directions differently.
Good question, but does one go about measuring really the angles of triangles? And how does one do that? How does one?
How is that?
I think the measurement of triangles you can do within the solar system. You can bound signals of satellites, for example. You can really do that. Now, for overall astronomy, I think what you really do in order to convince yourself that you have isotropy and homogeneity is to measure the speed with which galaxies are receding from us. And if everything is isotropic, then there should be a particular kind of distribution for that. We should have a strict Hubble law. So you can check for isotropy this way. Yes, now what I wanted to say is that since the Einstein equations are nonlinear equations, complicated nonlinear equations, they have solutions that have rather counterintuitive behavior or, well, just interesting behavior that one wouldn't expect thinking as we usually do in terms of linear theories. Gravity is not linear. So, for example, there are solutions to the Einstein equation such that spacetime is looking today pretty much as it is, spatially homogeneous, seems to be expanding in all directions at the same rate. But the full solution will show that in the past, it was nothing like that. It just evolved such that at the moment it looks like this, and in the future it won't look like that again. You see, because the Einstein equations are nonlinear, this sort of behavior can occur. And explicitly, solutions of that strange kind have been found. If you want to know more about the space of solutions of the Einstein equation, I would recommend that you look into the text by Wainwright and Ellis. I think I have the reference to that in on our homepage, on the course's homepage. So we will make the assumption that spacetime is spatially flat, and that if it expands or it contracts, it does so isotropically everywhere and in every direction by the same amount. This will cut down on the number of degrees of freedom of gravity very much. And that helps us a lot because it means that the Einstein equation becomes a much, much simpler equation. But of course, we have to buy into this assumption first. But astronomers tell us that this is a pretty good assumption. So when we assume that spacetime is spatially flat and isotropically expanding, then what is a suitable choice of coordinate system to describe such a spacetime? What sort of coordinates should we use for the time variable, and what sort of coordinates should we use for the space variable? Let's start with discussing time. From astronomy, we know the galaxies mostly move away from another according to the Hubble flow. The further away a galaxy is, the faster it is moving away from us. This is simply expressing that everything is moving away from everything. And the further away two things are, the faster they move away from another. Of course, it's not quite true for stuff that is close together, such as this box of chalk and that box of chalk. They are not moving away from another. And it also applies to our galaxy and the neighboring galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy. They are not moving away from another. In fact, they are rushing towards another. And in a billion years or so, there's going to be a collision of Andromeda with our galaxy. So it's not strictly true that all galaxies are moving away from another. But as soon as you look at large enough distances, you find that galaxies actually do, because they may have what is called peculiar velocities, such as the Milky Way, in which we live, and the neighboring galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy. They have peculiar velocities. They actually move towards another because of their mutual attraction. See, they're so close to another that the mutual attraction wins over the expansion of space-time. Space-time between Andromeda and us is getting more and more because space-time is expanding. But they're moving towards each other with sufficient speed that overall that's they're getting closer. And if you look at two galaxies really far away from another, then their peculiar velocities don't matter. So the terminology is that galaxies in general move away from another. The further away they are, the faster they move. And this is what is called the Hubble flow. A deviation from that is when galaxies have, on top of the Hubble flow, also a bit of a movement towards, let's say, the neighboring galaxies. That is what is called a peculiar velocity. Of course, we will neglect peculiar velocities in the cosmological treatment. So we will assume that the peculiar velocities are just small extra additions to individual galaxies, but we're not going to look at individual galaxies anyway. So we will approximate the situation by saying that all of the matter is pretty much homogeneously distributed in space-time, so it's not condensed into galaxies. We will just assume it to be distributed homogeneously, which you can do once you look at not the scale of a million light years, which is not much bigger than a galaxy, but if you look at the scale of hundreds of millions of light years, then you have basically a relatively smooth distribution of matter. And we will assume that this matter is staying put where it is. We will neglect peculiar velocities. And the only reason why they move is that more space is being created in between them. So all matter is assumed to flow only along with the Hubble flow, not have any peculiar velocities. This suggests that as the time variable, as the time coordinate in cosmology, we use the time t that an observer who is flowing with the Hubble flow observes on his or her wristwatch. That could be us. Basically, apart from this little bit of peculiar velocity that we have when we drive in the car or because we are attracted by Andromeda, apart from that, we're not really fast. So we are basically at rest in the universe, and we're just going along with the Hubble flow. Our wristwatch is a pretty good approximation. And that is a definition of the time variable which has the advantage that it's really the same definition anywhere in the universe. You just say that whoever goes with the Hubble flow uses his wristwatch. Once we are dealing with fluctuations, as you will see later in the course, we will see that there's a problem with this definition of the time variable. See, if you have fluctuations in the matter density in the universe, for example, because of very early quantum fluctuations, if you have fluctuations in the matter density, then you have fluctuations in the expansion rate. And that means that this definition of the time variable as the time of the definition of time as the eigentime of an observer that flows with the Hubble flow is not unique. Because it depends on where you are. Are you in a region with an overdensity of matter, or are you in a region with an underdensity of matter? But for now, we are not dealing with fluctuations just yet. We are looking at still the completely homogeneous situation. Later, quantum fluctuations will disturb. But for now, it's just homogeneous, and therefore this is a clean definition. Time is the proper time of a freely streaming observer. And that is, by the way, also the time that is quoted in popular science when they say that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. This is the amount of time that an observer sees on his wristwatch who was created at the Big Bang and has been traveling since without peculiar velocity. Obviously, if you take an observer and speed that guy up, then if it was traveling fast enough, then between the Big Bang and today, it might only be 5 minutes, right? Because if you're really fast, your watch will not show that much time. This is the 13.7 billion years is the age of the universe according to this definition of time. Okay, that's going to be, at least initially, our time variable. What about the space variables? Space coordinates. What coordinate system should we choose there? Well, it's going to be convenient to choose what is called co-moving coordinates. We will call them x1, x2, x3, just as if we used coordinates as always. You know, take pieces of wood 1 meter long and then attach them one after the other, make a mark, and count meters. But it's not going to be as easy as that, really. We're going to use a co-moving coordinate system. And this works like that. At one time, let's say t naught, which could be today, we measure distances the way that I just explained. We take 1 meter long rods and assemble them into a big lattice, which we can do because we assume space is completely flat. And then we measure how many meter rods you have to go to the right, left, up, down, whatnot, and you get the three space coordinates then. So this is how you measure distances today. But our coordinate system, our space-time coordinate system, we choose in such a way that at a later time, we still get the same numbers. And that's not trivial if space-time is expanding. So for example, look at the galaxy that's really far away from us. Not Andromeda, because that has peculiar velocity, but something that's really far away from us, far away galaxy. If today we take a lot of rods and build a lattice right up to this other galaxy, then in our coordinate system that we made out of those wooden rods, we will find that this other galaxy has some coordinates, x1, x2, x3, which is really the number of 1 meter rods that we need to walk along to reach that other galaxy. Now, in a billion years, that galaxy and our galaxy will be much further apart because space in between them has been created through the expansion of the universe. But really, they didn't move. They were just swept along with the usual Hubble flow. And therefore, it is useful to stick to the same coordinates then. The galaxy, the same galaxy, should still have the same coordinates. For that, of course, we have to have an adapted coordinate system. Our coordinate system will need to grow along with the universe. If the universe is expanding, let's say it doubles in size, or to be precise, any distance doubles in size, then it means that instead of 1 meter rods, we now use 2 meter rods, and we count them. And of course, that's giving us the same number now of rods after the universe has expanded by a factor of 2. So we use a space-time coordinate system such that the spatial part of it is a function of time so that the spatial coordinate system grows at exactly the same rate as the universe itself, so that all galaxies always keep the same triple of numbers that denote their position in the universe. Always the same triple of numbers. Okay? Which means that same triple of numbers actually means different distances, okay? Because the units change. What is 1 or 2 or 3 changes over time because the coordinate system expands over time. This is very convenient, not only for our purposes here, but imagine you are studying peculiar velocities. You're an astronomer, you're interested in peculiar velocities. Well, then that would be the right coordinate system for you. Because it would tell you, that, because in this coordinate system, every galaxy that has no peculiar velocity would always be at rest. its coordinates never change numerically. But if a galaxy has peculiar velocity, then you will see that its coordinates will change. Okay, so it's adapted to studying, for example, peculiar velocities or fluctuations, as we will see. So if we let our spatial coordinate system grow with the expansion, then we call this a co-moving coordinate system. Remember that we are dealing here with space-time coordinates. We are not just setting up a spatial coordinate system at one time. We have to set up a spatial coordinate system at every time. And we choose it such that we choose our space-time coordinate system in such a way that over time, the frame of the spatial coordinate system grows along with the universe. This means that the metric with our present choice of coordinates for time and space looks like this. The metric tensor has a 1 here because it's our wristwatch. It's measuring the time coordinate. Now, what about the space coordinate? Well, the minus sign is the usual minus sign, okay, for space-time. Now, what about the a squared? A is the so-called scale factor of the universe. And remember that the metric is being used to calculate the distance squared. That's why you have a squared here. So at the time t naught, which we may choose to be today, the scale factor is going to be 1. Because we use 1 meter rods, for example, and measure the coordinates as multiples of those. So it is just 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1 today. But then at a later time, the universe has expanded. But the coordinates of a faraway galaxy are numerically still the same. So if you want to know what the distance is now to this galaxy, then you have to take those coordinates, square them, and multiply them with the scale factor that takes into account how much the universe, and along with it, the coordinate system has expanded. So this factor is necessary so that when you calculate a distance, at any time, you get the proper distance. For example, let us look at the proper distance d between two galaxies. Let's say ours and another galaxy that's far away. And let's say that the distance in coordinates between us and the other galaxy is this. So delta x1 is the difference between the x1 coordinate of the other galaxy and our x1 coordinate. X2 is the distance between the difference between the other galaxy's x2 coordinate and our galaxy's x2 coordinate, and so on. Today, let's say, or at any point t, which we may call t naught, but it doesn't have to be actually. I think it's better if we don't use t naught. Just any time t will do. So at any arbitrary time, let's say we look at the difference between the coordinates, the space coordinates between the other galaxy and us. And we look at the time t. Then what is the distance between us and that other galaxy? Well, as usual, we take the metric tensor, we plug in the coordinate distance between us and the other galaxy in the metric tensor, and that gives us the distance squared. We take the square root of that, that's the distance. And explicitly, from our expression up here, we get what that is. You see, there's no contribution from this 1 because we're calculating that at equal time. We're looking at the galaxy over there now and us here now, so we are making a distance measurement at equal time. So delta t is 0. And then we get that the delta x's contribute to the spatial distance in this way. And the metric tensor has these a squared factors here. So we obtain the absolute value of g mu nu of delta x mu delta x nu. There's no delta t because it's equal time. And g mu nu has this factor g squared on the diagonal, multiplying all of those. and therefore we can pull the A in front, and we can just give that. This is the coordinate distance, the numerical distance of the coordinates, which stays always the same between two galaxies as the universe is expanding, because the numerical positions of the galaxy stay the same, because the coordinate system is expanding along with the spacetime. But when you calculate the actual distance, you see that the scale factor comes in and corrects for that. So even though that stays always the same in time, this takes care of the time dependence. All right. So what now is the dynamics of this scale factor? This is really the only degree of freedom that the spacetime still has, because we know that it's spatially flat. And the function a of t will describe its expansion. So the function a of t, the scale factor, is calculated in this way. First of all, calculate the energy momentum tensor of the dominant field in question. In principle, there's the field of the electron and the field of the photons and the quarks and all of those. But in early universe cosmology, it's going to be just a scalar field that dominates the scene energetically. And that scalar field we may call phi. So what we do is we calculate the energy momentum tensor for the field phi. And then, well, when we do that, we obtain an expression in phi. We don't obtain numbers. We obtain the expression in phi. And then we have to solve two things simultaneously. We have to solve the equation of motion for this Klein-Gordon field phi, for that scalar field. And we have to solve the Einstein equation for g mu nu, where the Einstein equation is ordinarily very complicated. But since we're assuming that the metric takes this simple form, the Einstein equation actually doesn't look all that bad, because you have really only one degree of freedom, only one function to determine. So while the Einstein equation ordinarily looks like this, it really simplifies a lot when you take into account that the metric takes the simple form. So as we discussed before, we have two degrees of freedom. We have a of t that describes the behavior of the spacetime as a function of time, and we have phi of t, which describes the behavior of the Klein-Gordon field as a function of time. And we have two equations of motion. We have the Klein-Gordon equation, and we have the Einstein equation. So we have two unknowns, two equations of motion. In principle, we would like to solve them both quantum mechanically. The trouble is that we can't really do that. For the Klein-Gordon field, yes, we can do it. And we just covered in the last lecture how to do this. But our methods don't apply for gravity, because that's highly nonlinear. Even if you make that simplification for the metric, it still stays a very highly nonlinear theory, and we don't know how to consistently quantize that. So what we can do, and fortunately is sufficient for early universe cosmology, is to do a half-baked job. So basically, we solve the Einstein equation classically, and we solve the Klein-Gordon equation quantum mechanically. Now, the Einstein equation, here it is again, has the curvature tensor on the left-hand side, cosmological constant here, and the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side.
Why didn't quantum mechanics make it hard to solve it quantum mechanically?
Well, you don't have a vector space of solutions, for example. And remember that our solution method of the last two lectures heavily relied on that. But it's deeper than that. It means that perturbation theory is ill-defined. So the Einstein equation we want to treat classically. The trouble is, though, that the right-hand side, the energy momentum tensor, is a polynomial in the Klein-Gordon field. But the Klein-Gordon field has hats on it. The Klein-Gordon field is quantized. So we would have on the left-hand side something classical, and on the right-hand side, an operator, or an operator-valued function, or an operator-valued tensor-valued function. Whereas this is all number-valued. So we'll have to do something about this. And what we can do is we can do the semi-classical approximation. The semi-classical approximation is to say, well, yeah, this in principle should be a polynomial, an operator-valued polynomial here in phi. But what if we just take the expectation value of this? So we take the quantum expectation value of t mu nu, and that gives us a number-valued function on number tensor valued function of space and time, namely this. So if the quantum field is in the quantum state omega, then we calculate this expectation value. Remember that this in principle has a hat on it because this is a polynomial in phi hat. So we calculate these expectation values and then plug them over here. In this way, we have something number valued here. And here we have something number value that should be okay. Well, it should be, one would think. But keep in mind that there is a fundamental problem with this. Just think of what this really is, such an expectation value. It is inherently a dangerous quantity to work with. Independently of what you do with it, the definition of it already is crying out trouble. Think of it this way. This is the energy momentum tensor here. As a function of space and time. Now, we will know one thing for sure from quantum mechanics, which is that you cannot know position and momentum simultaneously, or energy and time simultaneously. That's the essence of quantum mechanics, if you like, the uncertainty principle. Now, look at this thing. What it says is that you can calculate energy and momentum as a function of space and time. So you can know what is at one particular time, one particular point in space, what energy and momentum are. Certainly, there is something needs to be done. It cannot be as simple as this, that you just take the expectation value and plug it in here. Well, but as long as you are far away from the uncertainty limit, see, in daily life, for this thing, for example, we can pretty much know at the same time what its position and momentum is. You have to go to really extreme situations to hit the uncertainty principle bound. So in cosmology, we can only hope that we are not hitting that bound, that the circumstances that we will be dealing with are more like this eraser than an electron in a small system where you would have the uncertainty principle really playing an important role. So hopefully, the uncertainty principle is not going to mess this up. But we will have to check that in hindsight. We don't know beforehand. All right, so in principle, we have to solve the problem in this way, that we take the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation and solve them both simultaneously. Classically, we can do this, and then quantum mechanically, we can treat at least the Klein-Gordon field. In practice, what we will aim for is the following setup. We will say that there's a Klein-Gordon field that dominates all over all other fields. There's the Einstein gravity. And we will solve simultaneously the Klein-Gordon equation for that dominant Klein-Gordon field and the Einstein equation. So we will obtain a phi of x and t, and we will obtain an a of t. So all of this is still classical. And then we will say, well, this was the situation where we have complete perfect homogeneity in space for the metric and for the Klein-Gordon field. And now we allow for small perturbations from that. So we will allow that the metric is a little bit wiggly, and we will allow that also the Klein-Gordon field has a little bit of fluctuations. And these small perturbations we will quantize. Now, before we do that, we will do another change of coordinates. And that is a change in the time variable. In principle, we should be happy with the time variable that we have. Couldn't be easier. Just take your wristwatch. The only mistake that you may incur is that you are not taking into account the peculiar velocity that you may have. It turns out that for the purpose of cosmology, another time variable is a little bit more convenient. And that time variable is not conceptually really different. It's just a rescaling of that wristwatch time. It's a function of that wristwatch time. You see, the metric in our time and space variables, so in the proper time of a wristwatch, of a co-moving, of an observer that is flowing with the Hubble flow, and the co-moving positions, in that coordinate system, the metric takes this form. But as you may imagine, it would be more convenient for calculations if space and time were treated on an equal level. Here, they are not quite the same, because the space coordinates are multiplied with a squared, but the time coordinate is fine. See, if we could treat space and time exactly the same way, then we could write the metric as being proportional to the metric of special relativity. So if, for example, here were an a squared, then we could just pull the a squared in front of everything and would have the special relativity metric here. In fact, this can be achieved. We can rescale the time variable in such a way that we get any arbitrary factor we want there. In particular, we can rescale the time variable such that we acquire an a squared over there. How do we do that? Well, you see, a delta t squared for our old time variable should be an a squared times the delta eta squared of a new time variable eta. We want that the new time variable requires a factor a squared where the old one didn't. So to this end, what we need is that d eta by dt is 1 over a. How do you see that? We'll take the square root of this, and you have delta eta is equal to 1 over a times delta t. Or infinitesimally, you have d eta by dt is 1 over a. This is just a heuristic derivation. But of course, you can convince yourself that if you actually go through the transformation rules of a metric tensor, for a change of coordinates that leaves the space coordinates the same and makes the time coordinate go from t to eta, then the metric really will become this metric, but with an a squared over here. But first, we will have to solve that differential equation. So we want a new time variable such that eta as a function of t differentiated with respect to t is 1 over a. So that is to say, if we put the dt on the right-hand side, it's that eta of t is 1 over a dt. Right? So we just put the dt on the right-hand side, integrated both sides, and we get eta and the integral over 1 over a t prime. So if you're given an expanding space-time with a scale factor a of t, then you can calculate what the corresponding conformal time variable is. This is the name of the new time variable, conformal time. And you can calculate eta of t by integrating that integral here. Right? So if a of t is given, it's an explicit function here that you need to integrate from some starting time that's completely arbitrary, which you may choose to be today or minus infinity or something. So you can work out what eta is, the new time variable, as a function of the old time variable. Now, why is it called conformal time? Well, it's conformal time because the metric in terms of the new variables looks like this, which is to say that the metric tensor is now exhibiting a proportionality to the metric tensor of Minkowski space. But that means that really, all the angles are preserved. This is a map between two metrics that's preserving angles because it's just scaling everything. So it's conformal. This map is a conformal map, and the time variable that achieves that is called the conformal time. Just like in the last lecture, we had the letter the letter G standing for two completely different things. One was G, the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. The other one was G, the metric. Here, I committed a similar sin. Eta mu nu is the metric of Minkowski space. And this eta is the conformal time. Please don't mix them up. You shouldn't, because this thing has indices. Okay, so we are still dealing with exactly the same expanding space-time. We just changed the coordinate system for it. And in the new coordinate system of the x being co-moving spatial coordinates and eta being the conformal time, we have that the metric takes this simple form. It's going to be very handy when we calculate the Klein-Gordon operator, for example, the D'Alembert operator. Remember that the metric with the lower indices is the inverse matrix of the metric with the upper indices. So therefore, since this is the Minkowski metric times a squared, the g with the upper indices is the Minkowski metric times a to the power of minus 2. We also can now very easily calculate all the other ingredients that we will need in the action integral, and that we will need in the Klein-Gordon equation. For example, the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g is simply a to the fourth power of eta. How do we see that? Well, remember that the metric is a diagonal matrix multiplied with a squared. The determinant of that is therefore the product of all the elements on the diagonal, so that's an a squared times an a squared times an a squared times an a squared. Or more precisely, it's an a squared times a minus a squared minus a squared minus a. That's a minus a to the fourth, but we take the absolute value of that, that's an a to the eighth, because it's a to the power of 2 times 4. We take the absolute value of it, that gets rid of the minus sign, we take the square root of that, that gives us a to the fourth. So now we have all the ingredients to write down the Klein-Gordon field in FRW spacetime. We're still neglecting the potential. We will later reintroduce it, but for now we neglect it. And then we obtain the action of the free Klein-Gordon field on the FRW background. This is the general expression for the action, no matter what the spacetime is like. Here is the expression for the Klein-Gordon action on FRW spacetime. This is a to the power of minus 2 times the Minkowski metric. Here we have it, a to the minus 2 times the Minkowski metric. These are just the partial derivatives. There they are. M squared, square root of g is a to the power of 4. There it is. And the d4x is valid for all sorts of coordinate systems. But we've chosen a particular coordinate system, and then this is the conformal time eta, and this is the co-moving space coordinates. The Euler-Lagrange equation always looks like that, no matter what the space-time looks like. But in a special case here, it takes this form. There are two ways of arriving at that. You can take the general Euler-Lagrange equation and simplify it by putting in the particular form of phi that we have and g. Or you can rederive it from an action principle. We will check that all of this is the same. When I write down the Klein-Gordon equation in this way, I've introduced primes. This double prime means second derivative with respect to the conformal time. And often in the cosmology literature, you will find that primes denote, as here, differentiation with respect to the conformal time. Whereas dots on top of functions indicate derivatives with respect to the proper time. Now, when you look at this thing here, and I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this is really the Klein-Gordon equation that follows from this in our special case. It's not hard to check. When you look at this Klein-Gordon equation, do you notice that something is qualitatively different from anything we've seen before? When it's really different, even taking into account the driven harmonic oscillator? Yes, which one? The second one, right. And how does it look like? What would it mean physically? Any intuition?
Well, it's just friction. Or some damping friction device. Hmm? Or some damping device.
Yes, it would be like damping or friction. It's a term that's proportional to the derivative of our degree of freedom. Ordinary harmonic oscillators have only a second derivative, second time derivative, and then they're proportional to the elongation. And that's these terms here, the phi. The phi prime, that's new. As you said, it would correspond quantum, ordinarily for harmonic oscillators to a friction term. But actually, it turns out it would be an anti-friction term. It would not be damping, but it would be increasing the oscillation, actually. It could. It depends on what the sign is of A prime. And the thing is that when you have a harmonic oscillator that has a friction term to it, then, well, first of all, we haven't really studied that. And secondly, we should expect that funny things might happen because it means that you have dissipation. Either you have dissipation or anti-dissipation. It means that energy goes into heat or comes from a reservoir of heat and contributes to your harmonic oscillator. So in order to give a harmonic oscillator with friction a good treatment, we should take into account that other system that contributes this. Where does the friction heat go? Or in this case, if it's anti-friction, where does it come from? Fortunately, it's not necessary to go to that length. It turns out that while the Klein-Gordon equation on an expanding space-time takes this form with a friction term, we can actually, with a little trick, make that term disappear. The trick is not an approximation. The trick is simply a change of coordinates, a change of variables such that in terms of the new variables, we end up with a harmonic oscillator that simply doesn't have that feature. A harmonic oscillator that has the usual energy conservation, there's no dissipation or anything of the kind. And since it's just a change of variable, it should be okay. Of course, we'll have to check that it's okay. So our strategy to deal with this extra term is this. We will try to change variables from phi of eta and x to a new field, not phi, but chi of eta and x, such that the equation of motion, when re-expressed in terms of the new variable chi, simply doesn't have such a friction term. We're completely free to choose how chi is expressed in terms of phi. It's a huge freedom. We could choose chi to be 7 times the third power of this plus 27 times the seventh power. Or much more complicated things. We have an enormous freedom in defining the new variable chi in terms of the old variable phi. Maybe we can choose chi to be such a function of phi that the Klein-Gordon equation re-expressed in terms of chi is simpler. And in fact, that is possible and not difficult at all. It turns out that this simple definition will do. So I'm claiming that if instead of the variable phi, we use the variable chi, which is the scale factor times phi, then the Klein-Gordon equation re-expressed in terms of chi will not have a friction term. And here's how this goes. Here are the ingredients. From the Klein-Gordon equation, well, in the Klein-Gordon equation, we have the first derivative of phi, and we have the second time derivative of phi, right? Remember, here we go. We have the first derivative of phi and the second derivative of phi occurring, and we will have to express those in terms of the new variable chi. Here we go. first derivative of phi is first derivative of phi, right? Phi is chi over A. Phi is chi over A. And you see we get two terms. We get a term from differentiating the 1 over A, that's this term, and we get a term from leaving that alone and differentiating the chi. So we are generating an extra term here. And the space derivative of phi is going to be trivially 1 over A, the space derivative of chi, because the space derivatives just go through the 1 over A. 1 over A is simply a spectator as far as space derivatives are concerned, because A is a function of time only, not of space. So therefore, now that we have expressed phi prime in terms of chi and chi prime, we can now do two things, really. We could either calculate now the second derivative of phi, and then use the first derivative and the second derivative, plug it into the Klein-Gordon equation, and see that really everything works out nicely, and and that the Klein-Gordon equation now expressed in terms of chi doesn't have a friction. Or we could go a slightly longer route, but it would be worth it, and take the expression for chi that we found and for phi and plug it into the Klein-Gordon action. Of course, from the Klein-Gordon action, we can then calculate what the Klein-Gordon equation is in terms of chi. It will be useful to calculate the Klein-Gordon action because eventually we need a canonically conjugate momentum to chi. And how would we guess that? We'll have to work with the action in order to get out that. So having expressed phi in terms of chi and having expressed phi prime in terms of chi, we can express the Klein-Gordon action in terms of chi. All occurrences of phi and phi prime have been replaced by the proper expressions in terms of chi and chi prime. So here we go. This is the Klein-Gordon action now in terms of the new variable. By the way, one thing I can already point out to you here is that the Klein-Gordon action has the second, or has the derivative squared. If you do partial integration, it has the second derivative. It has the time derivative squared. It has also the space derivative squared. This is like the Laplacian. And then it has this term here. If space-time were not expanding at all, and the scale factor were 1, which we can always arrange by definition now, then this term here would simplify because A would be 1, so this is just m squared, and A double prime would be 0 if space is not expanding. In which case, this is just the mass term, m squared times chi squared. In other words, on expanding space-time, what we see here is that our harmonic oscillator has what looks like a time-dependent mass. Effectively, it's like a time-dependent mass. See, this is exactly how we would see a Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space. Everything is just like on Minkowski space, except that we have a time-dependent mass. Effectively, something that acts like a time-dependent mass. It's something that multiplies the chi squared, which is not simply m squared, but m squared a squared minus a double prime over a. Now, what might that mean in terms of a discussion that we had several lectures ago, that we have a time-dependent mass? Yes, exactly. It's the we have a chance for parametric excitation. So we're going to end up with harmonic oscillators that are not driven by external forces, but they can still get excited because of parametric excitation. And in fact, look at this. Is this positive or negative? You see, if the space-time was not expanding, this term would be absent, and this would be the proper mass term. But what we see here is that if A double prime is big enough, this term, which is negative, can overwhelm that term, which is positive, which means that this effective mass can flip sign. in extreme circumstances, when the expansion of the universe is dramatic enough, this term can overwhelm that term. And instead of having a harmonic oscillator like that, you could have that, you know, this bracket goes closer to zero, and eventually it would be potential like this, an inverted harmonic oscillator. Now, how do systems behave in an inverted harmonic oscillator? It's a runaway solution, right? And this is what will make the quantum fluctuations expand. This is what will blow them up as the universe expands. But of course, you can't see that from this point. I'm just telling already where the mathematical ingredients are. All right, so what we've done is we've expressed the Klein-Gordon action in terms of this auxiliary field chi, which is nothing but A times phi. So what are the equations of motion? In principle, we can't really be sure that if we calculate the Euler Lagrange equations from this, that we would get the same equation of motion as if we had taken the Klein-Gordon equation for phi and replaced phi by chi. I mean, how do we know that, the two paths are the same? How do we know that taking the Lagrange equation in terms of phi and then expressing phi in terms of chi, we get the same equation as if we had done this in the action replaced phi by chi, and then through the variational principle get the Euler Lagrange equations, and then end up with the same equation of motion for chi. How do we know that? Actually, we can prove this very easily. So the question is whether the action principle, the principle that the variation of the action with respect to phi equal to zero, yields the same Euler Lagrange equation, it's the same Klein-Gordon equation, as varying s with respect to chi and setting that equal to zero, that question can be settled very easily, very abstractly. So yes, they lead to the same Euler Lagrange equation, simply because if this is zero, then that is zero, and vice versa. Simply because the transition from phi to chi, or from chi to phi, is invertible. You can always, if you know phi, you can calculate chi. If you know chi, you can calculate phi. So that means that if you write down the equation 0 equal to ds by d phi, you can use the chain rule and write this as ds by d chi, d chi by d phi. And clearly, if this is equal to 0, which means that the Euler Lagrange equation with respect to chi holds, then the whole thing is 0, and therefore ds by d phi is 0, which means that the Euler Lagrange equation with respect to phi holds, and vice versa. You could just replace in this equation all phi's with chi's and all chi's with phi's. So we may as well calculate the equation of motion directly in terms of chi from the action in terms of chi. We just have to keep in mind that the physical field is phi, not chi. So for example, when we calculate the energy momentum tensor, it is a polynomial in phi. Of course, we can also turn that into a polynomial in chi. But principally, the physical quantity that matters, that directly enters into the energy momentum tensor and therefore curves space-time, because it's on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, that quantity is phi. Chi is just a convenient variable. So even though the phi hat are self-adjoint operator valued fields and the chi hat are self-adjoint operator valued fields, you should really think of the phi as being the observable and not chi, even though they just differ by a scale factor of A of t. Okay, so if we take the Klein-Gordon equation, if we take the Klein-Gordon action for the field chi and do the variational principle, set the variation with respect to phi equal to zero, then this is going to be the Klein-Gordon equation. And as an exercise, please verify that this is so. It is really what we should expect, because if you remember how it looked like, the time derivative and space derivative parts were exactly like on Minkowski space. And the part with the mass was a little bit modified, namely exactly by this modification. What used to be simply a mass term became mass squared times a squared minus a double prime over a. Again, we see that we get the Klein-Gordon equation, except that the mass has been replaced by this bracket, something that is time dependent and has the potential to change sign. As I said, we could have arrived at this in two ways. We simply take the Klein-Gordon equation for phi and substitute for phi the suitable expression chi. Or, as we actually did do it, we expressed the action in terms of chi and then calculated from the action the equation of motion for chi. So far, this has been classical. In order to prepare for quantization, we need the canonically conjugate variable. But which canonically conjugate variable? See, we have phi and we have chi. They both have canonically conjugate variables. Are they the same? Are they not? If they're not the same, which one is the good one? Which canonical commutation relation should we impose? Between phi and its canonically conjugate field, or between chi and its canonically conjugate field? Or are they perhaps the same? Well, let's see. So we will need the canonically conjugate field, let's say, to pi to start with. What's the canonically conjugate field to pi? And I'm putting here a superscript chi just to indicate it's going to be the canonically conjugate field to chi. All right? Easy to do. From the action, we read of the Lagrangian. No, what I did, I just removed one integration, namely the integration with respect to time, the conformal time. This is the Lagrangian. It is a function of chi and its time derivative. Well, time derivative. And the canonically conjugate field is dl by d chi dot, or sorry, but dl by d chi prime. And that is this. It's chi prime itself again. Very simple. Remember that, remember from our general discussion of action principles of the Klein-Gordon field in generic curved space times that the canonically conjugate field in general could be very complicated. It could be an expression that involves even space derivatives and so on. But because we assume that spatially nothing is really going on, it's everything just spatially flat, we don't have any such complications. So the canonically conjugate momentum field to chi is simply chi prime, the time derivative of chi. But then what is the canonically conjugate field with respect to phi? Well, here is the Klein-Gordon action expressed in terms of phi. And we see that in terms of phi, we have an a squared or a to the minus 2 prefactor in front of the time derivative. Therefore, when we calculate the canonically conjugate field to phi, namely pi superscript phi, as dl by d phi prime, then it is a squared phi prime. Actually, a minus 2, right? Oh, yes. Yes, thank you. I nearly made a mistake, thanks. Okay. So for those who didn't see, there's an a to the minus 2, but there's another a to the 4th, and overall makes an a squared. Okay, so let us compare now. How are these things related to another, the two canonically conjugate momentum fields? Well, here's the canonically conjugate momentum field to chi. It's chi prime. But chi is a times phi. So it's a times phi prime. This gives us those two terms, namely a phi prime plus a prime phi. Now, we can express this, the phi prime, in terms of the canonically conjugate momentum field to phi. See, phi prime over a, let's see, phi prime times a is pi superscript phi over a. So this term is the same as that term plus this. So therefore, clearly, the canonically conjugate momentum field to chi is not at all the same as the canonically conjugate momentum field to phi. Well, we shouldn't have expected that they are the same. But then how about quantization? Well, the natural thing to do is, or the obvious thing we have to do is, that we work with the physical field phi. We impose canonical commutation relations between the field phi and its canonically conjugate momentum field. They should have equal time commutators of this form and the rest as usual. And it turns out that in terms of the fields chi, in terms of the field chi and its canonically conjugate momentum field pi superscript chi, and the commutation relations look just the same. As it happens, they are the same equations, these and that. Actually, I shouldn't say as it happens. There's a whole theory of so-called canonical transformations that make sure of this. But since we haven't covered that theory of canonical transformations, we should convince ourselves by actually proving this. So in terms of the chi fields, these are the commutation relations, is the claim. Let's check that. When those are trivial to check, that they are the same as the ones above, let us look at this one. So here we have chi and its conjugate momentum field. We express chi in terms of A times phi. That was its definition. And we express the canonically conjugate momentum field to chi as whatever we calculated it is. We did it just a slide ago. And then let's see what we get. We have that phi hat is to be commuted with the pi hat plus a term with the phi hat. Well, this and this is just the same. They commute. So this and that will have non-trivial commutation relations, but we know them already. We know what the commutation relations between phi and its conjugate momentum field are. We are forced to use the usual quantization rules. And here's a prefactor of A, and here's a prefactor of 1 over A. They cancel out, so we are left here with the commutator between this and that. As I said, this comes from canonical quantization. We know that this is I times the delta function, and there we go. So this commutator is the same as that commutator. So it would seem that changing from this variable phi, from the field variable phi to the field variable chi, was a fairly benign thing to do. Nothing bad happened. We really have two different fields, and we have two different canonical conjugate momentum fields. But the commutation relations imply each other. We can either quantize the chi or the phi, same thing, really. So it all seems pretty straightforward. Well, there is a little matter, though, that we have to address, which is that when we look at the Lagrangian is always the same. You can express it in terms of phi or in terms of chi or any arbitrary variable you like. The Lagrangian is always the same. But then when we express it in terms of phi and do the Lejeune transform to replace phi prime by the canonical conjugate momentum field pi phi, then we obtain one Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian that arises from Lejeune transform with respect to phi. If, however, we take the same Lagrangian, write it in terms of chi, and do then a Lejeune transform to arrive at a Hamiltonian, there's absolutely no reason to expect that the two Hamiltonians are the same. Numerically, even. I mean, if you take a field phi and plug it in there, you get a number out of it. Or number density, the Hamiltonian still has to be, well, no, you get a number out of it. And if you take the same field, express it in terms of pi, and plug it in there, well, you know you get the same number. Do you get the same number when you do that? I mean, are the two Hamiltonians really the same up to a change of variable, or are they not? Any guesses there? I'm asking those who have not read the lecture notes here. Would you expect it to be the same or not? See, the thing is, if they're not the same, we are a bit in trouble, it seems, because the Hamiltonian is what? It's the energy. Energy curves space. So which one is curving space, and by how much? Well, it turns out that they're not the same. And one of them is better than the other. But we will see why and how. So remember how they're calculated. This Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian that arises from the Joyner transform with respect to phi, is the new variable times the old variable. This was the old variable, phi prime. We replaced it by the Joyner transform variable, pi. New variable times old variable integrated over minus Lagrangian. Here, new variable times old variable minus Lagrangian. Usual way that the Joyner transform operates. So here's the big question. How can both of those Hamiltonians be valid generators of time evolution? Remember that this is what Hamiltonians were invented for. They are to be generators of time evolution. You have the Hamilton equation classically, and you have the Heisenberg equation quantum mechanically. By construction, because of the Legendre transform, we have that I times the time derivative of phi is the commutator of phi with the Hamiltonian H superscript phi. We're sure of that. We don't have to prove it again. We made sure of that when we studied the Legendre transform. But by the same token, we also have that I times the time derivative of chi is the commutator of chi with the Hamiltonian superscript of chi. Both Heisenberg equations have to be true. But remember that normally we would think that no matter what variable we look at, I f dot is equal to f h, no matter what f is, whether it is phi or chi. There should be this equation. The Heisenberg equation should be true for all observables, and there should be just one Hamiltonian in the game. But here it seems like, well, depending on what observable you look at, you have to use different Hamiltonians for that. Or can we conclude that they are the same? It turns out that they are not the same. Well, the answer is not that difficult, actually. You just need to remember that this is not what you were taught in quantum mechanics. There is a little extra term in general. If your observable depends on time also explicitly. So, for example, if you have in quantum mechanics, for F, you choose just x hat, or for f you choose p hat, or for f you choose x hat plus 7 p hat squared. Yeah, you can just all plug them into here. However, if you choose another f, an f which is sine of t x hat plus cosine squared of t p hat to the 7th power or so. For this f, it's not true, this equation. But instead, you have to add this. You have to add plus I d by dt f hat. Okay. Ordinarily, this term is absent because this is the derivative with respect to the explicit time dependence of your observable. In this case, it would be differentiating the sine and the cosine of t. And now remember that if we work with the variable phi, then the variable chi is a derived one, which is A times phi. A has a time dependence. And therefore, you can write down a Heisenberg equation for chi using that Hamiltonian of phi, but then you have to add the extra term here, this extra term. And vice versa. You can also write down a Heisenberg equation for phi using the chi Hamiltonian, but then phi has an extra explicit time dependence, which gives us an extra term here. But let's do this explicitly. Well, let me just show you explicitly first that the two Hamiltonians are really different. Well, from chi equal a phi, and the Heisenberg equation for phi, we obtain that I times 1 over a chi, because this is what this is what phi is. Phi is chi over a. So this equation becomes I times phi, replaced by chi over a prime, equal to 1 over a chi, this is phi, commutated with h. So that's just the same equation as that. I've only replaced phi by chi over a. I'm working out the derivative now, getting two terms. Differentiating the 1 over a, that gives me that. Differentiating the chi gives me this. And this is just carried forward. Now what you see is that we obtain I times 1 over a chi prime minus this term that comes from the derivative equal to the commutator. Let us multiply the entire equation by a. That gets rid of this a 1 over a here, gets rid of that, gets rid of the 2 over here. And we throw that term on the right-hand side. And there you see what happens. If we write down the Heisenberg equation for chi using the Hamiltonian for phi, then we obtain an extra term here, exactly this extra term here, because chi is a non-trivial function of time with respect to phi. It is phi over a. That's exactly this term here. On the other hand, if we look at I times chi prime and its equation of motion, its Heisenberg equation of motion with respect to its Hamiltonian, then obviously this is the equation that it obeys. We know that from the general rules for Legendre transforms. So we have that both equations hold true. This equation, where we write down the equation of motion for chi using the Hamiltonian for phi, the Hamiltonian that arose by Legendre transforming with respect to phi, or phi prime. And here's the equation of motion, the Heisenberg equation for chi using its own Hamiltonian. And if we compare that, we see that for these two equations to both hold true, the two h's can't be the same. You see, if they were the same, then this term would have to vanish, but it doesn't. Okay, so the two Hamiltonians are really different. And it's not really a surprise once you remember that when you have observables that have an explicit time dependence like this one, then it's then their equation of motion, Heisenberg equation of motion, has this extra term, which is, of course, absent if the explicit time derivative is zero. So since there are multiple Hamiltonians, apparently, we have to ask which, if anyone, is the energy. Okay, I mean, one of them's got to curve space, but they can't both if they have different values. So what's the right one here? Well, remember that one usually defines the energy as the generator of time evolution. That is what classical mechanics would tell us. It is the thing that you use to evolve things forward in time. Now, the classical version of that is the Hamilton equation. That's what the Hamiltonian is good for. But as we now see, in the setting of general relativity, there are many generators of time evolution, many Hamiltonians. After all, there's not just phi and chi. We could have defined many other fields. Chi happens to be phi over a. But how about phi over a to the 7th power? It's another field. So there are many, many different Hamiltonians you can define. Fortunately, in general relativity, energy is not defined in this way. Energy is not defined as the Legendre transform of the Lagrangian. Obviously, it couldn't be because that's not unique. We saw that. No, instead, in general relativity, energy is as the zero-zero component of a tensor. Remember, look at the career that, that energy has made. Initially, according to Newton, energy was a scalar. You know, for Newton, there were only translation symmetry in space and rotation symmetry in space. As far as space transformations are concerned, energy is a scalar. So for Newton, energy would have been a scalar. But then in special relativity, you might have thought of energy as being perhaps a zero component of a vector. The four vector of the momentum, four momentum vector, right? But this is for point particles. Really, we now know that particles are really fields. And they just register in discrete portions in detectors. But properly described, every particle is, I mean, every particle is better described in a quantum field theory. So they're really just fields. And fields have energy momentum tensors. And the, remember, that was the variation of the action with respect to the metric. And the zero-zero component of that is the energy density. So with Einstein, we define the energy or the energy density not as a generator of time evolution, but as a generator of curvature. Here's the Einstein equation. Remember, on the right-hand side, we have the energy momentum tensor. And so we see that if this thing is big, that on the left-hand side has to be big. So you can view this equation in such a way as matter, or matter's energy and momentum, is curving space. And the zero-zero component does a particular thing. It's also curving space, or curving space-time. So the energy momentum tensor is generally defined as the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric up to a decorative prefactor of 2 over square root of g. This is the energy density. And when you do that for the Klein-Gordon field, explicitly it becomes this polynomial expression in phi. And the zero-zero component of that is what is called the energy density. Why would we call it the energy density? It should better relate to what we are used to as the energy density. Otherwise, why would we call it energy density? Well, explicitly, if you plug everything in there for our present setup of an FRW spacetime that's expanding according to the scale factor A, then this expression here becomes that expression. Please do check if you have a minute. It's not hard to do. This is the expression for the energy momentum tensor. And I'd like to invite you as an exercise to do this. Verify, first of all, that this really comes out. And then secondly, calculate explicitly what the Hamiltonian is in terms of the field phi. One of those two Hamiltonians that we studied. And then show that this Hamiltonian is indeed the integral over all space over this energy density, over T naught naught. Okay, so you take T naught naught, the energy density according to Einstein's definition, and then this is just the usual volume form. Integrate that over all of space. That is the Hamiltonian H phi. And so you see that one of the two Hamiltonians that we looked at is a preferred one. As far as the equations of motion are concerned, you can work with whatever you like. Also, the commutation relations don't care whether you quantize the chi and its momentum field or the phi and its momentum field. But when it comes to energy, and energy is important when it comes to coupling things to gravity, then the Hamiltonian corresponding to phi is special because it is the integral over the energy density. And then, just to verify things, calculate also h chi and see that it is not the integral over the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor. All right, so I think we have now everything set up. We only have to quantize it now. Okay, any questions?
Why is H phi not scalar?
And why is what?
Why is H phi not a scalar? Or is that?
No, it's not a scalar. H phi is not a scalar.
T zero zero is a scalar.
No, it's not a scalar.
It's the zero-zero component of a tensor.
That's right.
Which, okay.
It's not a scalar. The component of a tensor is never a scalar. Okay. It's just like the second component of a vector, not a scalar.
How about you're integrating on
the No, that doesn't make it a scalar either. You're integrating over space. Because T naught naught is an energy density. You see, the energy momentum tensor gives you for every point in time and space a 4x4 matrix, which is the energy momentum tensor. Its zero zero component is the energy density. So that's the density. Now, if you integrate it over all of space, you get your overall energy. In practice, you may easily end up getting an infinity there. That's why it's useful to work with the energy density, because that has a greater probability to come out finite than calculating the overall energy. Even a constant field could easily give you an infinite energy if it has a potential that's just a little bit elevated.
Is this a general criterion for choosing Hamiltonians?
Well, it's not so much of a criterion because, basically, most people would just say, of course you use that. But is it because phi is the primary variable? It's the observable in the game. It's just that when you go through the various calculations as we did today, you notice that there are other Hamiltonians in the game. And you may, and in fact we will, actively work with another Hamiltonian. The one for the chi, the H with the superscript chi. We just have to keep in mind that this H with the superscript chi is not energy density directly. But this is the energy density. So that we are not misled to thinking that if the energy H, or if H chi is big or small, it doesn't immediately mean anything for how that affects curvature. Because you actually have to calculate this thing. So it's just a matter of caution. What it says is that if you do the Lejeune transform for phi, you end up with the right thing. You get the Hamiltonian, which is just the integral over the energy density. But there are many other Hamiltonians that generate time evolution that do not generate the curvature. So you have a divergence of the concepts of energy. You have energy as generator of time translation, and you have energy as generator of curvature. Only this energy is both. Yes, well, that's exactly how it's defined. You take the action for the phi variable, then express it in terms of the chi variable, and do the Lejeune transform so that you replace chi prime by the canonical conjugate. And that gets you from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian. That's exactly how it's defined, the Hamiltonian with the superscript chi. Any more questions?